Hi, I'm Paul Boag and welcome back to Digital Insights. Today I want to talk to you about psychology and how to use it in the right way to improve your conversion rate. Whether you're seeking to improve the user experience or to boost your conversion rate, you need to know your audience as well as possible. You need to get inside their heads. Now, the primary way we achieve this is through user research, a topic I've written about extensively in the past. But also, a basic understanding of psychology certainly doesn't hurt. And in this little podcast, well, actually, probably not so little, I want to share with you just some of the many interesting quirks about human behavior that can have a profound impact on how we make decisions. You see, we all think that we're rational, intellectual beings, but we're not really. In truth, our evolutionary roots still drive much of our decision making. We actually share a lot in common with our animal cousins, a lot more than we dare to think. The most ancient parts of our brain, often known as the reptilian or primal brain, still drives much of our behaviour. This primal brain has some fascinating features that impact our behaviour even in today's modern world, characteristics that we need to be aware of when designing websites intended to encourage action. See, if you jump back a few hundred thousand years, you'll find that the primal brain was crucial for our survival. It helped us assess danger and controlled our fight or flight response. What's particularly interesting is how we assess danger. One of the techniques it uses is to judge whether something is familiar or unfamiliar. Everyday things tend to be safe and predictable, while strange things are potentially dangerous, and so we treat them with suspicion and with caution. That has ramifications on how we create our websites. By ensuring that our websites feel familiar, then they feel safe. Create familiarity, however, is a tricky balance. You could use it as an excuse to copy the competition or well-known sites like Amazon. However, that would be an oversimplification. Equally, you could use it as an excuse to suggest you should never redesign a website. And it's true that website redesigns aren't always a great idea and do create a sense of unfamiliarity. But that's sometimes exactly what you need in order to shift users' attitudes towards a company. Instead, if we do redesign, we need to do so with care, ensuring that there is a sense of familiarity with what went before and other related sites. We can also create a sense of familiarity with the experience itself. If the site behaves a certain way at one point, it should do so everywhere. Nothing's more disconcerting to the primal brain than shifts in layout or changes in navigational behavior. But the way that the primal brain assesses threat isn't the only unusual characteristic it has. There's another aspect of its desire for self-preservation that should be noted, and that is our desire to hoard. The primal brain evolved in a world of scarcity, and despite the fact that we now live in a world of plenty, hasn't really moved on. And that's why we feel the discomfort of loss twice as intensely as the pleasure of gain. The primal brain fears losing something. Unfortunately, when we ask people to act on our websites, we're almost always asking them to give something up. That might be something very apparent, such as money, or something a bit more abstract, like their personal data. In either case, the primal brain will be reluctant, and we have to work hard to demonstrate the overwhelming value they will get in return if we're going to avoid an adverse reaction from our primal brain. One way of doing this is to focus on the benefits our products or services provide, not just their features. Listing features requires us to think and make the leap into how those features will then help us, and the primal brain isn't very good at making connections like that. However, if we focus on listing the benefits of a product, then the primal brain feels less of a sense of loss. For example, the Apple website doesn't merely list the specs of its Macs. It talks about how those Macs allow people to do what they do. And that makes the value more evident to our lizard brain. Fortunately, there's one aspect of the primal brain that works in our favor, and that's its abysmal at planning. You can see this in toddlers who rely heavily on their primal brain. If you offer a toddler a candy bar now or two candy bars in future, they'll almost always take the immediate reward. from our perspective, as those seeking to encourage action, we can use this lack of planning to our advantage by delaying the cost of acting. For example, if you're allowing pre-ordering on your site, don't take payment until the product is actually released. You can even delay payment on immediately available products through things like financing or some other payment scheme. The primal brain will be less concerned if the cost is in the future. A great example of how this can be beneficial is the Save More Tomorrow campaign. Most people don't save enough for their retirement, despite knowing that they should, and that's because the long-term gain of saving is too abstract for the primal brain when compared to the short-term pain of loss of those monthly payments. The Save Tomorrow campaign deals with this issue by encouraging people to sign up to start saving in the future. For example, people might commit to start saving when they know they're going to get their next pay rise or bonus. The results of this approach are dramatic, encouraging a considerable percentage of people to start saving. And that's because the primal brain fails to respond to that possible future cost. It's just too abstract for it to process. Now, if you run a charity website, the potential of a Give More Tomorrow campaign is immediately apparent, as charitable giving is hard for the primal brain to swallow, despite the fact that the vast majority of us actually want to be donating more. But the primal brain is not the only aspect of our thinking we need to know. There's also the role of System 1 and System 2. In the superb book, Thinking Fast and Slow, we're introduced to two modes of thinking called System 1 and System 2. Most of us associate System 1 with unconscious thinking, the kind of thinking that is fast and automatic. It's the autonomous and efficient method of thinking that we use that requires very little energy or attention. For example, System 1 is used to recall a fact like the capital of France or the answer to 2 plus 2. It also allows us to make instinctual decisions based on very little information. Opinions like the trustworthiness of somebody you meet or whether it's safe to overtake in a car. At face value, System 1 appears to have superpowers, but it is prone to error because it takes shortcuts to achieve the incredibly fast results that it does. It tends to ignore any information that's not immediately available. Instead, it's more concerned with a believable story. For example, if I told you that a person called Jim, who is quiet and studious and has a fantastic attention to detail, is a librarian rather than a farmer, that would seem to make sense. It makes a good story. And that's understandable because the description fits the stereotype of a librarian. But what your System 1 is ignoring is the fact that there are 20 times more farmers than librarians. You made the assessment purely on what you knew and chose to ignore the fact that you might not have all the information. What this teaches us is that we shouldn't overwhelm people with information. We don't need to give them a lot of information in order to persuade them to act. The tendency is to add more and more information to our sites in an attempt to convince people, but that actually doesn't help. Too much information is likely to overwhelm System 1, and that will wake up System 2. Now, System 2 is what you'd probably describe as your conscious mind. Although it's much slower than System 1, it is much less likely to make mistakes. It's more deliberate and analytical, and it enables us to address more complex questions like what's 28 times 6 or learning a new skill, something like that. The drawbacks of System 2 is that it's slow and takes considerable effort and energy when compared to System 1. It also is so detailed orientated that it becomes suspicious and overanalyzes things. That's a problem for us as we try to convince people who because they're more likely to overanalyze a decision and ultimately fail to act. System 2 feels like it's a lot of effort for a task like using a website, and we're also more hesitant when we're using it, meaning we're often reluctant to actually take action. One upside of System 2 is that because of the effort involved, it doesn't like to work for long. We use it sparingly and shift reoccurring tasks from System 2 into System 1, which is why we often talk about muscle memory when referring to things like driving or riding a bike. is also why sites like Facebook or Amazon feel so intuitive. We've used them so much that we can now use them without waking up System 2 at all. You might be wondering at this point why you should really care about System 1 or System 2. And the answer is that far more of our thinking and decision making happens in System 1 than we might think. We want to believe ourselves to be rational decision makers, but we're not. And that impacts how we need to go about building our websites. Oftentimes, we simply take the path of least resistance, and we don't want to wake System 2 up. We make thousands of decisions every day, and most of those decisions are easy. They're decisions like whether we want a drink, or which pair of socks to put on, or whether to respond to that notification on our phone. These types of decisions are primarily automatic and unconscious, and in most cases we aren't even aware we're making them. And so, unsurprisingly, these are handled almost exclusively by System 1. But more challenging decisions, such as which laptop to buy or where to eat out, are harder to answer and so tend to be a more conscious choice, a decision that's made by System 2. The problem is that System 2 thinking, as I've said, is hard work, and so we tend to avoid it. So instead of waking System 2 up, System 1 will substitute a challenging decision for a simpler one. For example, it regularly replaces complicated questions such as, is this person trustworthy, with a simpler one like, does this person look like other trustworthy people I've met? That's why it's so hard to diet. Counting calories is hard and requires System 2 to be fully engaged. Instead, System 1 simplifies the question of, which food is most healthy for me to eat right now, to the simpler question of, am I hungry and do I like this food? Of course, most of the choices we want people to make on our sites are harder. Decisions about making a purchase or signing up for a newsletter. When faced with these kinds of decisions, if left to its own devices, System 1 will either substitute the choice of signing up for a newsletter with a question like, do I like getting spam? Or it will give up entirely. Fortunately, there are two things that we can do to avoid this problem. First, we can simplify the question for people by emphasizing the positive benefits of signing up for a newsletter, for example. Let's say you sold sports equipment. Right? If you ask people to sign up for our newsletter, they have to weigh the pros and cons of that decision. But if you say, sign up to get fitter, System 1 can easily answer the question, would I like to get fitter? Second, if we can't control how the question gets simplified, we can be sure to address that simplification or any other objections people might have. In other words, immediately alongside a call to action to sign up for a newsletter, we should make it very clear how much users can expect to hear from us, and that way they're not going to be concerned about being spammed. But there are other ways we can help people decide without them having to think too hard. And one of those ways is to be sure that we consider their perception of things. Because we're inherently lazy, System 1 tends to ignore information not immediately at its disposal and instead creates a story that seems plausible based on what it knows. That means we can easily misinterpret what's going on and jump to conclusions. Let me give you an example of what I mean. I work with a lot of universities, and one of their goals is to encourage overseas student recruitment. In student interviews, we discovered that many of these students were discouraged from attending some institutions because they didn't see any photos on the site containing students that were from their ethnic background. They therefore concluded incorrectly that this wasn't a place for people like them. They didn't stop to ask themselves whether they had all the facts. They just made a judgment based on what was in front of them, which was the photography. Now, we can counterbalance these kinds of misconceptions by priming users to help shape their perception. We can use priming in all kinds of ways to influence behavior. For example, in experiments, supermarkets have found that if they play French music in the store, they will increase the sale of French wine and reduce the sale of wine from other countries. Now, the principle of priming has some interesting ramifications for us as web designers, not all of which can be particularly ethical. We have to use priming for good and not just see it as a tool used in dark patterns. We can use it to prepare people for their experience of using our app or website. Now, I've already talked about how photography can be used to prime students' perceptions, but imagery is not the only tool at our disposal. Colour is another powerful priming tool because we associate different colours with different emotions and behaviours. For example, at the most basic level, users in Western countries will be less likely to click on a red button to a green one because we've been conditioned to associate red with danger. We can also use layout to prime user expectations. More significant, more prominent elements will be seen as more meaningful and so given more attention. There are all kinds of ways we can prime users, from the associations we make with our products to the number of times the site features a particular product prominently. For example, by associating your product with happy, smiling people, you prime users to subconsciously expect the product to make them happy. Equally, showing a product multiple times primes them to consider that product as significant. Of course, this can be dangerous. Priming can set up false expectations too. If you prime people to think your product is going to deliver a specific result and it fails to do so, that can prove damaging to your reputation and by extension long-term sales. Before we wrap up what has turned into a very long podcast, I would be remiss if I didn't mention at this stage the influence of others in our decision making. One of the substitutions we make all the time when faced with a complex decision is to ask ourselves, what would other people do? It's easier to rely on other people's judgment than make a considered informed decision ourselves. And that's particularly true the more complex the choice is. For example, when faced with a series of very similar options, we tend to go with the decision that we consider to be the most popular. That's where ratings, reviews, and testimonials become critical to the success of our websites. They have a massive impact on our decision making, and so we can use them to give people confidence in the choice they're making. Now, it's important to stress that the goal here isn't to manipulate people into making a particular decision. As I've already said, ultimately that's damaging to your business over the long term. Instead, we're seeking to help people make a fast, informed decision that leaves them confident in their choice. We want people to make fast decisions not because we want to rush them into buying, but because the longer they take to make a decision, the less confident they will feel about it. A lack of confidence will then lead users to abandon the decision entirely or go into the decision primed to believe that they're making the wrong choice. That increases the likelihood of them being unhappy with the result of that decision. Unhappy decisions are bad for business. They lead to more unsubscribes, more buyer's remorse, more returns, and more complaints. And that's why it's so crucial to help users make sound decisions that they're confident in. And to do that, we need to understand them much better. But that is a subject for yet another post or podcast in the future.